Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's go.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Bingetown TV and our coverage of Amazon's The Wheel of Time. So it's been 2 years, I guess technically less, but 2 years since we've covered Wheel of Time. We're absolutely stoked to the max about being back. This is the exact crew that covered season one. So my name is Kyle, and then you'll hear from the rest of the three. I guess I'll be the host. I technically have read the most Wheel of Time, so I'll kind of be that guy for us. I've read all of the books. I've read, the first 10 twice, the first three times, which is kind of weird, but that's the truth of it. Before we get into actually talking about the episode itself, just very quick, Bingetown housekeeping. Best way to support us is just going to be subscribe whenever you're watching or listening on. You don't need to do it right now, but just keep that in your mind once you know, Paul drops a really funny joke and you're like, oh, I freaking like these guys. And then, you subscribe. So that's the best way to do that. And then the best way to interact with us is going to be our Twitter is at Bingetown TV. And then we have a Discord as well. The Discord link will be, I believe, in the description of this episode. And it should be very easy to join. That sentence just kind of came out of my mouth. I'll stop talking now. We'll get into season two, Wheel of Time, episode one, A Taste of Solitude. And I'll let the others that are on this call with me, they'll kind of introduce themselves.
Others on this call, like an actual work call.
Yeah, true.
Hi, my name is Dave. Yeah, I'm a newbie watcher. Well, obviously have watched the show, but I've never read the books. Really enjoyed season one. I'd like to think I was one of the more higher ones on season one overall. I think if you've heard the preview of season two that Kyle and Luke and I forget who else Jimmy did. Mm-hmm. They let you guys know that I thought this show was at least an A tier in my mind. I'm still feeling that vibe. This episode was incredible. And it's crazy to think that it's been 2 years. It literally feels like, honestly, very recently that we just got done season one. But we finished our season one rewatch and I really loved it on my rewatch. It's been a phenomenal show and season two continues to pick up where season one left off.
Yeah. Yeah. I am Paul. I'm the other rookie. And
you look so relaxed right now.
I am very comfortable and I'm very happy after watching. This is fresh off of my first viewing of season two, episode one. Like Dave, I'm a rookie coming in, saw season one because we didn't have anything to compare it to and it was, no source material. Couldn't really poke holes in it or anything. So it was enjoyable to watch. So talking to you guys about some of the complaints, I can totally understand why there are people in the community that aren't happy with what the show did, but from a rookie standpoint, loving it so far. Episode one of season two was pretty damn good as well.
So this is Luke. I am the other book reader on this recording. If you caught our coverage of season one, at the time I was about two or three books in. So basically the subject matter that's going to be covered throughout this season, I would have already have read it last time we were recording, but now since then I've finished the whole series. So not going to call myself an expert, but I'm right there behind Kyle with just the knowledge of the source material. And I will say right off the bat, we did not address any of the issues from season one that I thought we were going to. We'll talk about that later. But ignoring that piece of it, this was a great start to the season. It kind of felt timely that they just did it like a year after the last Beltane. So it really was a good reset, restart. This is not going to be a COVID affected season. So I'm hoping only up from here. And I already really liked the premiere. I'm ready to get into it.
All right. So the way that this episode is going to go, we will discuss the opening scene and then we'll kind of take the three main storylines on their own. So we'll talk about the Hunt for the Horn storyline, all of those scenes, and then we'll move to the White Tower, I think, and then Land of Moraine. Just essentially, you know, those are the three story buckets. That's how the episode itself went. So that's how our coverage will go. We're not just going to go chronologically jumping all around. It's just easier for everyone involved. All right. So, wow, we're really doing it. Wheel of Time coverage. Mm-hmm. So the episode opens with what is known as the Dark Friend Social in the community. They actually released this clip ahead of time, like, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago. I just made that up. But they released it essentially on the back of the season one finale. So many people have seen this scene already. But for me, this scene's really just all about perspective. It's just a really interesting look at kind of the other side of the fence almost. So we get a lot of info here. Just curious of what you guys were thinking as I kind of, you know, we're back season two and this is how we open it up.
This was awesome. I mean, it was going right into obviously the biggest villain. Any more of his backstory is great because, you know, we barely saw him season one. When he did finally get him in the finale, it was great. So a little bit more of him is always a good thing. And, you know, to show that the menacing Trollocs are actually kind of under his, or at least they respond to him well, that was awesome. It's hysterical that it's called the Dark Friend Social.
Yeah.
It's like the Dark Friend.
Thon.
Yeah. It's like the potluck. It's like, as all right. All right. Now that we're done with the meeting, now we can go to the buffet. Who brought the buff chick dip?
Who do you think would have brought the buff chick dip?
The pot on Fane, right?
Oh, yeah. Dude.
He makes a mean buff chick.
At one point, they were referred to, I assumed everybody at the table was referred to as the Chosen Ones. So I don't know exactly what that means, but we know the Dark One is a Chosen One, and assuming the other one's at the table. So I don't know exactly what that entails, but Pad and Fane, he was one. Maybe we know somebody else that was at that meeting and we just didn't see them.
The little girl shows up. She's calling for mom, who I'm assuming mom must have been at the meeting. So I'm just interested to see how these characters, you know, just interact in their daily lives. At what point do I start to not root for our main characters, because I fucking love the Dark One. I think the actor is incredible. Pad and Fane was obviously one of my, if you've listened to our season one coverage, Pad and Fane was one of my favorite characters from there. So like,
you were also a child Balda fan.
So. All right, yeah, maybe, yeah, we'll slow our roll a little bit, but this was really interesting. I mean, I just loved how the Dark One was kind of talking about monsters and like what really makes a monster. Like, do I seem like a monster to you guys? And, you know, the little girl replies, not really. And it'll be interesting to see where they go with that in the future, just because obviously, and to us, you know, we've been introduced to the Trollocs, like clearly evil monsters. But in this scene here, we get a little bit of a reaction to them getting like a hand brushed against them a little bit. So just awesome scene. Honestly, this might have been my favorite scene of the whole episode. It was just I craved Dark One content, and this was just like perfect.
We watched this like drunk as hell last night. And I forgot that we did that until I woke up. I was like, oh my God, I forgot we did that. To kind of go on that perspective point that I made and that you guys also are making, the thing with the Chosen is that, so in season one, we saw Steppen, I believe, is like doing like a little ritual with those idols, those seven idols, or the number is escaping me at the moment, but he calls them the Forsaken. And then here we get the reverse side of it, is they call themselves the Chosen. So that's kind of a little perspective flip. But the people at that table aren't the Chosen or slash Forsaken. The Forsaken are just from the Age of Legends, like with the original dragon, all that kind of stuff.
Because they did refer later in the episode, I think, to Pad and Fane. Like there was a sentence of them saying like Pad and Fane and Chosen. Like, I don't know. That's probably what you were thinking.
Yeah,
and I don't really know too much either.
The people at the table are just Dark Friends. I mean, they're obviously, I think, higher level than like someone like Dana, you know, who we met in episode three. But they're not at the level of the Chosen slash Forsaken.
We got a flash of a black ring, like kind of like the ones the Aes Sedai have, except there's just straight black. So I don't think we've seen that before. That's cool.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's like a sign of like a male magic wielder. That's kind of like where my head's at.
Or just like right a now. Dark friend.
I mean, yeah, or just a dark friend. But you're right. I mean, it looked eerily similar to the Aes Sedai ring. So that's just what I'm kind of hinting on.
There was a lot to unpack here, and you guys are already picking up on the good stuff there. Like the ring from the Aes Sedai is huge. And then we see that the symbol of on the bottom half of the robe,
or that not a herring.
Yes.
I feel like that just to me right away, I was just thinking like, I guess birds must have some kind of symbolic meaning here, because obviously
Ransword yeah, is the herring, and this was like an eagle or something. I couldn't really tell.
It's, I mean, you get the answers in the episode essentially. So like the what they show us of who's sitting there. So we get presumably an Aes Sedai because we have the ring. Then we have a Shinarin, which is this eagle person in the robe, which is we were in Faldara at the end of last season. In Shinar, the people that are from that big fortress city, they're Shinarins. We kind of get that confirmation later when we'll talk about the parent storyline, which will happen literally directly after this conversation. We get Padan Fain, obviously, is there. We have someone with just like freakishly long fingernails who's sitting there.
It's gonna be so hard to find out who that is when we introduce that. When we get
what a defining trait of a single person, just freakishly long fingernails. And then we get potentially a white cloak. There's someone there that's wearing all white. Obviously, they have the black hoods on and everything, but they have like the white pants.
I just imagine they have dark like, ones have bodies
the,
everywhere.
The white gloves and stuff.
That's the genius of the faction. And that's why I loved episode 3 so much from season 1 is because like the Dana reveal was one of my favorite parts. And this is the reason like they can be anywhere. And the other takeaway is that they're basically being told to hunt down Rand, but don't kill him if he can be turned, but then kill him if he can't be. That's like the huge takeaway. And this is exactly how book 2 opens. It's like the prologue. So we've been waiting for this.
Prologue. No, that's awesome.
It's a really good start to book 2.
Yeah.
It's a really good start to season 2.
It was a good way to do it too. Cause in the book, it's obviously it's from someone's perspective. So it's all internal thoughts of him, like thinking like, oh, like, you know, that's a Shinarin. Or like, oh, wow, there's someone that there's an Aes Sedai with the ring there. So like, they did a good job, I think, of visualizing it for the show medium.
But I live for those Padan Fain smiles too.
He's such a little rat.
He's so good.
We got the little girl in the very beginning when she was outside. She was just kind of on a plaque that was kind of the yin yang symbol, or like the dragon's fang, I believe is what that mark was called as well. So I guess this building. So
the dragon's fang is the male half.
So just like that black part.
Which is why it's like half the yin yang, and that's what they mark people who they say like this guy's a channeler or whatever. So that's what that symbol is. But when they're both together, it represented like the female and the male sides together.
It's like an old symbol of the Aes Sedai, essentially.
Mm-hmm. What you were about to say, I feel like was just like this meetup spot that they have. It is clearly going to be related to like some Aes Sedai historical building. I feel like personally, like maybe even from when like the original 3,000 years ago when the original dragon and you know Dark One fought.
Yeah, the pointed buildings and all the different like almost
what buildings.
The appointed building.
Got a six points. 6 points. Yeah. Also, this.
You guys are saying six. I could have sworn I counted seven.
I think it was seven.
Okay.
I might have just been stupid. Yeah.
As but, I think, like, the number seven means more to the story than it being six. So we're going to move into now just the Hunt for the Horn storyline. So this is our kind of reunion with Perrin and Loial. So we get Perrin, Loial, and then we're introduced to, we're reintroduced, I guess, to Uno. We get introduced to Lord Ingtar, who they didn't really name him as a character last season. There's two actors that look alike, like the guy who's playing Ingtar and someone that was in season one who were in that classic, I use sarcastically, scene with the Horn of Valyr and Padan Fain in the season one finale. There's another character named Missima is with them as well. Those are kind of like the named characters here.
Shout out the Last Kingdom, baby.
Yeah, shout out to our boy Citric.
So
I guess like before talking about things that happened here, just like a general take on like what you guys were feeling when we get, you know, we see Loial again, we see Perrin again.
So, I mean, we all watched it together. So obviously the book readers had a sigh of, I can't believe they did this kind of, and you know what, as even with someone with fresh eyes, I'm never going to be a fan of like fake out deaths like that. It's like, it's either you get stabbed multiple times, you're either dead or like you're living, like, and, but they made it so obviously that it felt like Loial was dead in season one that I was definitely shot. I mean, I'm certainly happy. Like, Loial was amazing, a very funny character. Love his character, and I'm glad that we have him back. But at the same time, it's like he was right on death's edge in the last season. Like, should be dead. And I agree, the other two should also be dead, especially when facing Eilis, who just completely are just skilled swordsmen. Apparently, and can just like slice off heads immediately. Like, I think all three of them should have been dead.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking Perrin's hair and facial hair
that looked good.
Great.
Yes, it did.
But yeah, kind of same thing. If I didn't pod with you guys after watching the finale, I would assume that like Loial is dead. Loial or Loial?
Loial.
Loial is dead. Honestly.
Yeah, they're fine.
So, you know, I wasn't exactly surprised seeing him here, but I would have been if I didn't talk to you guys. I was expecting some of the other guys to be dead as well, but they weren't. So again, the fake out just kind of in the rewatch is kind of like a weird
it's not even like we don't even get factor. To see like any like
healing or
healing or anything. Like they just appear and they're just healthy. It's like
part of me honestly prefer, like, I don't mind that they were just like, fuck it, we're just gonna roll with
it. But at least give us, like, if they're dying, like at least like cauterize some wounds, maybe, like in the last season, like give us something that makes us believe that they should live for the next season.
Top three biggest complaints from season one, without a doubt, was this stuff. And it really, it sucks because it takes away the anything to do with the dagger being just anything but a random dagger. That's the part that bothers me. We're going to have to just eat this because there's no, they're not going to retcon it. At this point, we're just moving on, I think. And we're just going
to get Fane soft. He didn't deal a finishing blow. Points deducted for Pat and Fane in my eyes.
Please forgive us because we don't have subtitles yet with the screener, so we can't have all the information fully clear. Mm-hmm. But what were they exactly talking about with, like, there's a new tracker, a sniffer? Are they talking? They're not talking about the eye patch guy, are they?
No, they're not. Yeah, so I guess moving forward with this storyline itself, just I think one important thing about the conversation that Perrin and Loial have on their own is that we're getting kind of confirmation. It's starting to get confirmation that they believe Rand is dead because Moraine basically told them that. Perrin basically, you know, implies essentially that Rand's not around anymore. When I first watched, I was like, oh shit, I forgot almost that that was is going to be like a thing. Like, they're all going to think that Rand's dead. So that's like an interesting little thread that's kind of ongoing throughout this episode, and then I'm sure it will be throughout the rest of the season. We basically learn that they're on the hunt for the horn. The second book is called The Great Hunt. The book is basically all about this, the hunt for the horn. Obviously, things are different. Rand, Matt, and Perrin and Loial all go on the hunt in the books, and it's pretty much all from Rand's perspective on this. So this is, I think, a better chance for Perrin to kind of shine a little bit.
Big audible.
Yeah, but I think it works well because so basically in the books, there's things called sniffers. It's a really interesting power, I guess, say, quote unquote. They can basically smell like violence and crime, which is like a really odd thing. But so basically they have a guy with them that can do that.
So they're proficient in investigation if we were D&D.
Pretty much. They sure. just get forced like to investigate murders and stuff. Like in the book, he says, like, I literally tracked a guy from like across almost like the whole continent who killed someone in Faldara, and like he could just smell him and track him.
I feel like that sounds like a very profitable ability.
Oh yeah, I mean, I guess. But one thing I guess is bad is that, like, you know, it's like very effective on them. Like, you just smell violence, I feel like would be like a little bad.
Kind of
doesn't,
like,
smell good.
Fuck you up a little.
You know,
bit.
Yeah,
kind of like ghetto
bad.
In a JJK.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm sure it would kind of turn you bad, maybe a little bit. So we meet this new tracker / sniffer. His name is Elias. This is a brand new character for us, obviously, in this season. It's a little bit of an audible from his character in the books, but I guess I'm just curious. Initial thoughts on Elias, and then obviously Luke and I will give our thoughts as well.
He had the eyes like Perrin, like
eyes
the beast.
Like Ember.
Yeah, not exactly.
Not like Ember.
Not Ember, but like Perrin when he goes like wolf mode. He seemed cool, but he seemed quiet. So I wonder if he can, you know, actually fight, or if he just tracks or whatever. I guess we'll see. Looks like a fighter. But Perrin, like, seeing the past with his wolf eyes, I was like, holy. Didn't know that was part of the package. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's, I think, kind of their visualization almost, because like the storyline in the books is essentially that the sniffer that they had disappears basically, and then Perrin knows that he can also do it, kind of, because of his like powers a little bit. Like, he has good eyesight and smell and stuff. But he's like kind of an internal battle of like, should I tell him? Should I not? Like, are they going to kill me if I tell him, type of deal? And then he eventually is like, okay, I literally have to do this.
So that was the visualization of him like sniffing and kind of being able, like, breaking down what happened.
Yeah. That's my interpretation of it, for sure.
It seemed like Elias kind of saw him do that.
Yeah.
Like, yo.
It seems as well that Elias can do the same thing, because he says, you know, there was a little girl that got away. So it seems like he obviously, you know, had the same level of visions and like could tell what happened there.
He looked exactly like Heimdall from Thor. I don't know if you guys, but great character so far. Very interested to see it. Like, he might be a mentor to Perrin. We'll see with the abilities that they're sharing. Who knows? But I definitely have him on my radar.
Yeah, pleasant surprise, because I thought this character was going to be cut from the story. But he looks amazing, like way better than he did in my head when I was reading the books. Yeah. Like, this is like a dream concept casting in my head. And I think he's going to be really interesting and a good scene stealer whenever he's around.
Yeah, they're really doing a good job, I think, of it establishing early the connection between Perrin and him. Like Paul said, I mean, the eyes is kind of a dead giveaway. He's also just like, He just stares at Baron, which I think is even more unsettling with the eyes that he has. So he's just literally just Jay chilling, just staring into Perrin's soul.
Constantly investigating Perrin. Yeah, like, what is this guy? Oh, he murdered 20, his wife.
20s all over the place.
So yeah, so then we find out as well, especially there's just like a bunch of bodies. There was a fight and we see that there was a dead Shinarin, and Loial kind of smacks us over the head with the connection we're supposed to make there, that he is the dark friend that we probably saw from the social, and he was the one that let in the Fades and Pat and Fane into Faldara at the end of, or in the season one finale, who killed everybody. Mm-hmm. Another note with just Elias stares at Perrin because he just does it again at the end of the scene. So yeah, then we move on to them kind of burying the bodies. They have a very similar, yeah, I said that word right, similar burial scene to at the I guess it's like episode 5 after like the huge
battle. Remnants.
Yeah, after the low game battle, which I think was just interesting. I think Steppen was supposed to be like from the Borderlands, so I'm interpreting that this is kind of like a Borderland funeral scene in my level. I mean, in my head, rather, it's like a, you know, a certain level of continuity that's pretty cool, that kind of culture. And then we get a very interesting conversation between Ingtar and Perrin.
I love this. I mean, so after rewatching season one, I actually wasn't too crazy about Perrin as a character. There were a couple characters on my rewatch that I kind of fell off a little bit, just like a little, and Perrin was one.
Name
Egwene definitely comes to mind, was one. Perrin.
You mean Paul's DR pick, Egwene?
Yeah.
I thought.
I think this is great depth for Perrin as a character. Like, this is something like, besides like the, you know, killing his own wife, which obviously is a story in itself, but like
putting that aside,
I mean, this is more depth for him as a character. I mean, we see here that he really, the anger that he has, like, he doesn't hold himself, it seems like, responsible for his wife's death. He more so blames Pat and Fane for the events of the Trollocs unleashing and then him being in that frenzy, which caused him to kill his wife. And so now we're getting this speech from Perrin, him just saying, look, I have all this rage. And when I see, the closer we get, the more rage I feel. And then when I see Pat and Fane, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I think this is just going to be really good character arc for Perrin, because obviously he, last season, we also saw him with the Tinkers, with the Way of the Leaf. So he has that whole knowledge of like peace, and like Loial has been preaching that to him a little bit in the beginning of this season and the end of last season as well, before Loyal's fake death. So it's just interesting that we, like, I think Perrin's going to be a very complicated character going forward, because he does want to follow the Way of the Leaf, but at the same time, he admits here that he has this rage building inside him that is just going to unleash at some point.
Yeah, that was good picking up on all that, Dave, because like, that's just his whole thing. He's just constantly fighting this internal struggle of just like trying to be peaceful, but like fighting his natural state of just like, you could tell he has this anger. He's like the gentle giant with like all this fucking rage inside. He's going to have the toughest scenes to write, because he has so much internal conflict going on, and it's hard to do when it's not a book.
Yeah.
That's why they're going to do a lot of these types of conversations that get you thinking about like his mindset, because it's hard to show that on the screen.
His story was already like one of the more interesting ones. Like, his character itself didn't like scream out to me, but the story of like, and the mystery of like what's going on with the wolves and his eyes, like that was all very interesting. So adding this depth of like, you know, character growth potentially for Perrin, I think that'll combine to be a good thing for us as watchers.
Question for you two right now, like, what is your just 5-second grasp explanation of what you think Perrin's powers?
I don't fucking know. He's like, he's basically like a wolf, but he can like, I don't know. I think I'm getting thrown off with the visuals of him like sniffing, quote unquote.
I'm also getting thrown off by like when this all started, because like, was it not like he got cut by a Trolloc and then all this stuff kind of started happening? In my head, I'm trying to piece together like, okay, did Elias in the past survive like a Trolloc cut, and like, now they're kind of like, maybe this is one of the Trollocs' abilities. I'm just going and pulling shit out of my ass. Like, yeah, maybe the Trollocs also are just naturally really good sniffers. They've mixed blood and like now they have a little bit of their power. I really have no idea, but I'm taking, at first in season one, I thought more of it as like a werewolf kind of thing. Like, he got bit by something and now he's going to, I thought he really was going to transform into a werewolf. I didn't expect him to get like investigative powers like this.
That is a really interesting connection to make.
I keep hinging on that.
No, it's really interesting to hear, because like, that makes sense. Like, if I'm thinking of it from a perspective of like not having any actual knowledge, like trying to piece things together, like that connection makes a ton of sense.
He, for all I know, he could have been born with this power. It's just coincidentally, I just keep hinting. I just keep in my brain, can't separate the fact that he got hurt by the Trolloc and then this shit started happening.
And I mean, they kind of hammer that home too with like the wolf scene in season one, where like it comes up and licks his wound and stuff. Mm-hmm. They're maybe unintentionally, obviously, like forcing that connection there. So it's not, I don't think it's wrong for you to think that way. They'll talk about it more and more. One interesting thing I do want to say about this is that, so we hear in the Dark Friend social scene when the Dark One kind of caresses the Trolloc and he says, like, you know, he's part man, part beast, and like it's so difficult to be both. I think that's, you know, an interesting thing to keep in mind when thinking about parent.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, just in general, I thought that was just great backstory because I don't know if we've ever been explained what a Trolloc actually was. Yeah. It was cool actually hearing that they are human. So I just wonder if they're like experiments gone wrong. Like maybe I got too much Witcher in my brain right now. This, like,
no, that's the right way to think. We'll get more information on it for sure, I believe. But that's definitely.
But you did tell us in season one though that Trollocs kind of like are half human and then like they're mixed with like it could be any animal hypothetically.
Yeah, they've kind of stuck.
So that's what, like, I'm thinking, like, maybe the Trolloc that attacked Perrin was like wolf related, like a wolf Trolloc, and that's what, again, I know we've confirmed that it's not that, but it's just,
that's not even a terrible idea though, like that this is how kind of how Trollocs are created in a sense, like you either are infected and if you're given up into the beast inside of you, whatever, you become a Trolloc in the end, but probably not.
Dude, add that to your manga.
Yes. I mean, that's not a terrible idea at all. Yeah, and I can totally see why you would think that, but that's just, I guess it's better for me to just say that that's not what it is.
We saw him.
Paul's writing a manga. Thinking.
We saw him Hulk out a little bit against Valda in like the tent, season one, and he like kind of got like beast like traits and stuff like that. So I don't know if he can go like full werewolf or like turn into a wolf or whatever, or just get like appendages or parts upgraded, if you want to call it like that or whatever, but.
You never go full wolf.
I want to see him go all in.
That's the struggle. And listeners, and obviously the four of us here, throughout season one, I was writing down all of your guys' takes and theories. And one of the ones that I love so much is Paul's series long take on Perrin is that he is like a reincarnated wolf king.
I'm in.
So I'm just in, I love
just,
it. I'm
just to put that out there, that was Paul's season one take. So
hell yeah.
And I'll try as much as I can to remember the things you guys said, and when they're kind of relevant to the conversation, I'll try to bring them up. You know, they're always up on the board. They're on the board in terms of if the board is my notes app on my iPhone.
Yeah.
But trying to verbalize them as much as I can on the podcast.
This
well.
Is going to keep doubling until we get closer to the app.
Oh yeah, I love going. It. I love it. And we'll check some things off as well. I want to shine a little bit of light on the Ink himself as well. I feel like we learned in this scene that he has like this perspective kind of thread that I think gets woven throughout the entire episode. You know, he has this level of honor. He has like a very like rational, not very emotional way of thinking. It seems like everyone kind of deserves this level of respect, even in death. Because parents asking him like, "Uno spit on this guy. Like, why are we fucking burying them? Like, he literally got hundreds of people killed and all this kind of stuff." And then he has an interesting take on the Pat and Fane thing, where he's like, "You might not like the fucking answer, but like everyone in the world like does things. They have their own reasons for things." Yeah, I don't think Perrin and Pat and Fane will ever have a sit down conversation, but I think it's just, you know, they're telling you, I feel like, a lot about Ingtar by his takes on these things.
It's just getting like so many anime vibes from that conversation, because it's like there's so many characters in anime that you just get introduced to and you're like, this guy is such a fucking dick, or he's such a loser.
Yeah,
you get a little bit of backstory and it's like, shit. I'm a terrible person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so like that's now, I like this conversation too, because again, like, I love Pat and Fane. I've loved his pure evilness so far, but it will be cool to see what his actual motivations are wanting to become a Dark Friend. Sure, the rewards are great and whatever, but like, it seems like for Pat and Fane, maybe specifically, there's going to be a little bit more to it.
And for Uno, just keep track of how many times he curses when he's talking.
Yeah, yeah. That was, I liked that they gave him that little scene to shine where he's like telling the story about how they almost had him. I love how Loyal's fucking with him too.
Even Loyal was laughing at him. I love that.
Yeah, that was good. So we do also learn the first scene kind of that Perrin's been writing Nynaeve and Egwene letters. We'll talk about the letter when we talk about their storyline. We're not going to talk about it here. We'll do the lantern thing, I think, all at once too.
Yeah,
there's a bunch of facets to that. It's probably not worth it to talk about it right now. So unless anyone else has anything to say about the Perrin storyline, I think we're going to mosey on over to the Moraine storyline.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're moseying. So this is the kind of opening beyond the Dark Friend social. We get Moraine carrying buckets of water. This is kind of our reintroduction to her. They're kind of just reminding us, essentially, that she cannot use the power at this point. That was kind of where her story ended in the season one finale after her interaction with the Dark One. It's just kind of showing us her mental state. Lan's mental state, obviously, is a big one. And we also get introduced to some new characters. So I think just kind of anything we want to talk about that's before actually talking about like her interaction with the ship captain guy. You know, reintroduction to the storyline. We meet Varin. We meet Adelaus. We meet Tomas. So just takes on these kinds of things.
Just her getting the water and bringing that up every day. We even learn a little about it, you know, later on. She says no matter what, every day she just picks up those buckets and brings them in. We saw her taking a bath and like trying to use the one power. So I don't know if that has anything to do with like the healing waters or like a connection to the one power. We saw like the healing pools or sacred pools or whatever in season one. So I don't know if that's like connected to this at all.
Or in the water or like later, like Egwene's cleansing water later in the episode. Like,
oh, well, yeah. I mean, that might be something different.
I'm trying to back you up.
Don't lump your theories in with my theory. So I don't know if that's literally just her like giving herself a purpose every day and just like trudging through, or if it's like her trying to get back into connection with the one power.
Mm-hmm. I would say it's like 99%. She's trying to stay alive.
She doesn't have the ring on that I saw.
Yeah, that's a good catch.
Land looks hot as fuck. That's going to be my comment.
You guys both, as they went to his scene and it just meet his abs, and you guys both like, oh. It just like came out of both your mouths.
And then he just started typing.
Yeah, and it was just like, all right, write that down.
Yeah, he's looking good. Land's great. He's one of my favorite characters personally. And Maureen, obviously, again, another favorite character. I just love so many of these characters. But she kind of annoyed me a little bit this episode. But we don't have the full picture of why, she's doing these things. So I can't get fully mad at her. But she was definitely a little frustrating to deal with as a Land supporter.
Well, yeah, freshly disconnected from each other, Warder and I.
Yeah, they're no longer.
Definitely not looking the same at all. Even when they're not together, they look like miserable alone.
Yeah.
So they're obviously both going through their own shit right now. We got introduction to a new character, right? Verin?
Verin with the, it's V-E-R.
Verin. Okay. Yeah. So I basically have her as the host of this Airbnb that Moraine and Lan are staying at.
Looks fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Looks like a great place to live. They had the little garden that they picked through one scene that we'll talk about a little later. Like, what a life. This looks great.
Yeah. GeoGuessr, I would guess. You know, they're in Italy, someplace.
Well, he is Italian. It came out of him. They're in the motherland, in the homeland.
Let me give some takes real quick. Just want to say that Verin, I'm a Verin stan. Like, I couldn't wait for her introduction.
I was looking at you while waiting for her to drop the name.
I'm sorry, but without the subtitles, can you just give me faces with the names that you're saying? So which one's Verin?
Verin is the one that was wearing like the brown vest who like said like, this is my house.
But it wasn't her house? Or
it is her house.
Okay, so she's the one.
Yeah, and then the other one that's wearing like all the colorful clothing and is like
land.
Yeah, and is like, she's obviously, you know, she seems,
what's her name?
Her name is Adelaus or Adelaus, I believe that's
so Verin's going to be a fun character. She was one of the first people I think cast in the off season between season one and two. So like we knew about her for a while. So I was really looking forward to that introduction. Bail Domon gets introduced too. I know we're going to talk about the content of that conversation because that's a huge part of Moraine's storyline, but another classic and just in the fandom, and just the way he speaks is always great too. Like they're nailing that, like the doobie.
Yeah.
I doobie.
That was great.
Coming here to like, yeah, I love all that.
My smile covered like my whole face. First time I heard that, I was like, oh, fuck yeah.
And then my only thing about the Moraine thing, we don't know if she's shielded with a tie off or if she's stilled. They haven't really made that clear yet, but I do love how it matches very much how Loghain was reacting after being gentled, where he was trying to get the Ammerlin seed to kill him because he was so like depressed. He was like faking like rage and stuff at her to this moment. Like Moraine is still crying like every day that she can't touch the one power. And it just really reinforces like what getting cut off from the power does to you. And basically everybody commits suicide once you hit a point after not living with it, after having touched it. So it's really good that they keep reinforcing that because they reinforce that like twice already since she's been cut off.
And I mean, season one, we remember Tom's backstory about his nephew, and he basically says that like once he was gentled, it, you know, however many years he might have lasted, months he lasted, he literally just killed himself.
He was just at dinner, just grabbed the knife and just cut his throat.
Yeah,
just insane.
So there, I mean, like Luke said, they're definitely hammering that point home. A little information here: Adelaus is hungover. She kind of seems like a partier, quite a whimsical person. And then we know that Moraine has had 19 visitors up until this point to the villa, and then this horseman that's coming will be number 20. So we find out, like Luke said, that horseman is Bail Domon. He is the captain of the Spray, which is a riverboat. In my opinion, he came off as a very interesting character. He seems to be like a collector of some sort, and they have just like a very interesting kind of like business negotiation here in this scene.
Davos vibes.
Yeah, I mean, just complete open floor, whatever the hell we want to talk about with this. I have a lot of written down, so like we'll talk, and then I'll cover anything we didn't cover at the end of it.
He hails from the land of Ilya.
Ilian with an N.
Ilian?
Yeah.
Do we know where that is? Have we been exposed to that before? I don't remember.
It's tough. They haven't done a good job, in my opinion, with the geography of things. Ilian's like all the way on the south.
Gotcha.
It's like the southernmost kind of point, almost, kind of.
And this dude just sails a lot, though.
Yeah, he's a riverboat captain. So there's a lot of rivers that kind of cut through the continent. So he just kind of, you know, is a trader that sails on riverboats. And that's kind of, you know, plays into the idea he's a collector. He likes, you know, old ancient things like that. His profession makes it easier to do that because he gets to go to a bunch of different places and he's trading all the time and things like that.
We got some currency, baby. We got some currency, some marks. So we got that. When she said 5 marks, so like 5 marks is a lot. And then she was offering like 50 marks, I guess, for the
queen. He set the price as that, but yeah.
Okay. So just to put it, so in my head, so like 5 marks is a lot of money. Like that would be.
Yeah. Okay. Well, she compares it to a Damani racehorse, which means really nothing to anyone that doesn't know. But that's, again, that's good.
She said it was like a really nice. Like,
yeah,
really
that's honestly, place. That's really good world building in terms of like stuff from the books. Like we'll eventually go to that place and we'll learn more about that. Yeah, and like that plays a role in that country. So that's like an interesting thing.
The currency system itself means nothing to our podcast. I just wanted to bring it up.
It didn't really mean shit in the books. It wasn't like a.
Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Just again, just good in world building.
And the Quain DR, just know that's just like a material that's rarer than diamonds. Like it is. And it can't be made. Most people never see it in their entire life. That's why it was casually worth 50 or 10 times the.
It can't be destroyed, right?
Yeah, it can't be destroyed by like even magic. Until like this, they're talking about like what the heck's going on, because it normally is indestructible.
Right.
But it's also called Heartstone.
Heartstone was what Rand and the Dark One were on.
Yeah.
The season finale of One.
It's the same thing. Quain DR is his name for
it. Obviously, some sort of connection there that Moraine's trying to do some investigation of it.
Like, why is it being destroyed?
Why is it cracking all over the world? I guess I have no idea. Literally nothing.
Yeah. So we learned that Mr. Doman or Master Doman came into possession of this a few months back outside of Kyrian. That's just like a really, really, really important, pivotal, famous city that we'll be all in and around. You know, we'll get all up in Kyrian at some point. But he basically says that a moon dial shattered one night. The dial itself had a poem written on it. And it was written in blood in the old tongue. He has a copy of the poem. Moraine fucking swindles his ass because, you know, as she says, Aes Sedai invented the game. We do get actually a little bit of world building based off of that, too.
The game.
He mentions the sea folk, just like if we want to call them a faction. They sail like the seas, obviously, the sea folk. And they're just like really infamous as like tough negotiators. Dealing with them business wise is like very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So we do kind of get that information a little bit here. So basically, she gets the poem. That's the whole reason why she actually called him there. She kind of, against, like he said, or like I said earlier, she kind of swindles him. And he leaves, but not before they have a very interesting conversation about men that are following him. I really like how when he first says it, she says, you know, your enemies are your own. Like, that's not me. I thought that was a good way to dismiss that. But we basically, he tells her, he doesn't know this, but she interprets this, that there's two fades following him. He mentions the town of Whitebridge. That's kind of important as well. We can talk more about that a little bit. And then he kind of goes on his way. So basically this scene, Moraine gets that poem, whatever was written on that moon dial that broke outside of Kyrian. And she kind of becomes obsessed with it almost after that.
And we still didn't get what the poem was.
Yeah.
So Moraine read it, but we didn't.
She was shocked. She was shocked a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it drove her actions for the rest of the episode.
The one comment I have on that is I think we actually did, I might have misheard it, but I'm fairly certain they said that he said that that stone cracked a couple months ago. And if I'm interpreting the timelines correctly, it sounds like the Rand Dark One showdown was at least like 6 months ago. So it seems like it wasn't at the same time. It's periodically happening over the course of whenever Rand sealed away the Dark One.
Kind of tough. I mean, he just says the spring.
Yeah, he said a couple months, but that, again, like he didn't feel confident with that answer, so it could have easily meant, you know, 6 months of when it actually did happen. So I just think I heard that.
I think it's purposely ambiguous.
Okay.
I think Paul's correct to pick up on or try to make these types of connections.
I think so too.
I'll take these next couple of scenes, then you can finish out the bucket here, because like a lot that goes on is just like a mini growth moment for Lan, because he goes up, he confronts Moraine, like, what's going on? You're cutting me off. The bond's gone. I'm not in your head anymore. She's kind of leaving him out to dry, and that's her way of protecting him, is what I'm kind of getting the vibes of. And he gets madder, runs off. Then he gets the lesson from everybody else at the Airbnb, kind of talking to him through like what it really is like to have been cut off from the power. And Lan could not possibly understand that sort of pain that she's going through. And she's actually doing a fantastic job from their perspective of not just being miserable and useless. So like, this is just like a little moment for him to really just reset and say like, okay, like I've been following her for 20 years. I'm going to continue doing this. Like he's getting frustrated, but there's a reason for all this frustration, and it kind of plays out and they mend it over the course of the last couple scenes. I don't know if there's anything specific you guys want to bring up about their back and forth before he kind of goes up and gives her the dinner and realizes she's gone. But that's all that really was. Like, there was that freak out, and you kind of took what I took from that.
I just like Lan's faith in Moraine when they offered, hey, do you want us to wait for your Moraine to finally come down? And he's like, yeah. I mean, tonight's the night. Like, I can feel it. Like, even though, like, they're, like, fighting and they're not themselves at all, he still is, like, hoping and caring for her and, like, believes she'll come out of it, even if he is acting kind of, I don't know, what's the word?
Like a baby?
Yeah. Harsh towards her. He's definitely being harsh.
Mm-hmm. The take that I have is that I liked when Tomas is the man, first of all. Mm-hmm. Fantastic old guy look. Top five.
I had the old guy look. I had the challenge because he said this about Tom Maryland in season one. I had to ask him, who would you rather look like?
Tomas. Yeah. Look at this guy. Are you kidding me? Dude, look at his flow. He is just, if I could look 50% as good as that when I'm that age, I'll fucking die happy.
He honestly looks like how Geralt is kind of supposed to be portrayed. Like, Geralt's supposed to be like an older looking guy. Yeah, he looks pretty good.
Yeah, dude, he's a fantastic old guy look.
With the sword in the hand, too. Oh, yeah. He's a fucking witcher.
This guy's a fucking beast. But he says to Lan, like, you know, maybe you should shut up and listen more. And Lan kind of makes the joke of, like, I think that's the first time in my life that anyone's ever told me to be quiet. That just reminded me of when we're in Shadow Logoth in episode 2, when Lan like explains everything and Matt's like, well, first of all, that's probably the most words you've ever said ever. Yeah. So that's just like a fun little thread that's running through. But okay, yeah, so Lan then goes, takes up the dinner. Moraine is gone. She's running away. That then turns into a battle with the Fades. I thought they did a fantastic job of this. It was dark. That's just like a classic TV complaint. When they do things like this, it was quite dark, but I felt like the concepts in it were good.
And screener quality is a little bit down compared to.
And there's a little glare on your TV. Yeah, things like that.
It's not Game of Thrones level, like pitch black. Like I could make it out, but it was, I think again, it was the TV glare. Like we watched it middle of the day. Like the sun is just beaming in here. Like if we had watched it, like how we normally watch it with all the lights off, like at nighttime, like it would have been fine to watch.
I think they did a great job though of showing how the Fades hide in the shadow. Use it, and how smart Moraine is in the first place to even
predict.
I don't know what she was doing when like she was dragging her foot on the ground, if she was intentionally trying to get it to like come over here and then like sneak it, but she,
that was so badass when she just turns and knifes him right in the head.
Yeah, like she just jumped, she stabs like a shadow is what I see. She stabs in the darkness and all of a sudden you see the face with blood and everything coming off of it. It's really sick. I mean, I was expecting her to be absolutely useless without her ability to touch the One Power. So it's really cool to see her putting up this huge fight when she's basically the husk of who she used to be.
My favorite part about this was the fact that Lan does come for that quick little hero moment, but they did not ruin the power. I'm going to say power scaling of this, where like one warder is going to sit there and take on four Fades, which are like kind of like the lieutenants, or I would say like sub generals. Like I wouldn't put them at the general level of like maybe the Chosen or Forsaken, but like they can't be something that one warder can take four of them on. Right. Like he got his ass beat, but he did take out at least two of them. That all tracked really well. And especially with the second level of the hero save coming in with, the Airbnb host.
My notes now are just literally Airbnb. It takes me a little bit to get used to this.
Baron is now an Airbnb host.
I have co-host of an Airbnb, and then Thomas, side Airbnb guy.
But I just didn't want the Fades to be nerfed too much, and it seemed like they were going to win if it wasn't for that second level of support of reinforcements that show up.
I guess it's hard to tell, but like they did kind of nerf them a little bit. They did an interesting thing with them, because like the ability to move through shadows, I thought, is fucking awesome. It looks great. Mm-hmm. They're really hammering it home. Which, in my opinion, I didn't get a ton of that from the book so much. I feel like it wasn't like as clear and like obvious as it is in this scene. But also, I mean, like in the books, it's like a very specific thing. You have to cut their heads off. Even if you cut their head off, like they're still going to be flailing around and stuff. And they really only die when the sun comes up is technically what it's supposed to be. So or maybe it's going down.
I was crazy about the Trollocs only attacking at night.
But no, you weren't. But but I don't know. I guess it's just kind of, I don't care that much, you know, that it's maybe different.
I mean, that's what Lan did on the first one. He comes in straight up, two shots it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was really cool.
I was curious about that because I feel like they did say there's only two fades and like I'm counting, like the fight's going on, like he knocks out two and I'm like, okay, that's it. And then like two more appear. I guess the information was probably a little sticky at first. Like he probably, the guy didn't really know how many actually were following him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I did notice that too, that Lan went in for the kill with only head decapitation.
Yeah. That's like, I guess like the surefire way. Although you do get the sound of Marine stabs it and you can hear it like screeching and like you can kind of hear it flopping around, I guess, for lack of a better term, on the ground. So I think that still tracks.
They also, when Tomas comes in.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong, but Tomas.
When he comes in with the flaming sword, is the fire another way to extinguish it? Because I don't think he beheaded it. I think he just stabbed it with the fire.
I mean, in my opinion, I feel like, yeah, I think you can set them on fire and cut their heads off. I want to say I could be borrowing that from some other type of fantasy monster, but
like probably a Demon Slayer with like the sun being related
to fire. Fair.
But I think that would be fair too. Like, the sense that, like, if fire is a source of the sun, like, why would it not?
And also, kind of, in my opinion, it's not a, like a crazy change to make. Like, I'm not going to fucking, you know, throw a fit over the fact that, you know, they're not just cutting their heads off. Like, it looked fucking sick. Mm-hmm. When
as long as they look like they got fucked up, that's all I need.
Yeah, Varen fucking puts the fire on the sword. And I don't think, I mean, that never happens in the book. So that's an awesome way, A, to show how to use the power and also, like, the connection between, you know, Aes Sedai and Warder. Like, that was sick. Like, he obviously, like, went in there and, like, it's a thing that they've probably done before where she just, like, lights his sword up and it was fucking badass.
That Lord could have Light. Happened in Game of Thrones.
The Lord of Light.
Yeah, I'm literally, fucking Thoros of Myr. And she's an Airbnb host and she's Thoros of Myr.
It times well that they did this because this is, like, the first episode we're really learning more about the different types of strands of the weaves. So, like, fire being one of them, that's pretty cool. Like,
hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Wrapping that around a sword and making it look amazing
about that, and like because it all seemed like here in this season they've emphasized the colors of the strands, where in season one it felt like it was all just white.
And for what it's worth, I think the strands look better already than they did in season one.
Season one, I feel like they didn't tell us enough about the power itself. It was like, I think it was very just kind of nebulous and like vague and like what the fuck is actually going on. Paul had asked a lot of questions about it, and I knew it would eventually get to a point where we would talk more about it, so I'm glad that they kind of, like you just said, hit the ground running with it in episode one.
Did it early on. They did the fake out with Moraine, and I was like, no fucking way.
Yeah. I literally, when I first watched, and this is bad, I guess, because I now have like this predisposition of like, oh, they're fucking it up. But I was like, no fucking way. She's about to channel right now.
Same way. I totally fell for that fake out. I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, kind of kicking it.
Yeah. I was like, please don't do this right now.
I would have cried.
Yeah. I was like, I think they deserve it, though. I feel like until they show us more evidence that like they're making the right decisions, mm-hmm. I mean, that feels overly harsh. I don't like being harsh, but I mean that's kind of the mindset I'm rolling with, where like I'm totally falling for everything, where I'm gonna be like, oh my god, they fucked it up, until like, you know, they actually show me. Yeah, exactly.
How about Lan's last line? He looks at her as they're both like bleeding out and he says, what aren't you telling me?
Yeah,
so obviously she's been trying to do something this whole time. Maybe the poem really is the catalyst that made her make the move in the first place to try to escape, but something is going on.
And I want to know too.
You fucker, you watch the next like two episodes, you know.
I mean, I want to know what she's not telling him too.
One last thing I will emphasize about the fighting and the shadows, the fades disappearing in the shadows, like teleporting kind of, is like they really emphasize, there's one shot I vividly remember of like the moon was just so bright, but because the moon was so bright, it created more opportunities for like obvious like shadows and like the abilities for them to appear behind them. So I thought the visual effects for this scene helped me understand that, okay, they're teleporting, like using the shadows basically.
Yeah. The sound, I feel like that they have everything about the phage, the music, the sound of it is great. Like I loved that it was like trying to chomp at land too. Like the sound of it sounds good. Like them coming out of the shadows sounds really cool. Like the shot of it, like with the moon behind it about to kill Moraine, like that was a sick shot. Like it just looks good. Also, Lan dual wielding swords was pretty cool. No one ever picks up a fucking fade.
Like that's a thing going forward.
That's pretty badass.
Yeah, I need two swords in his hand at all times.
Blades of Phage is like an important thing. And like we'll learn more about like the lore behind them and what they are. They're really like heavily poisoned. But also, I mean, it's literally like if you get cut with it and an Aes Sedai's not around, you're fucked. But obviously
dies that in season one.
Okay, cool.
Moraine does take a knife in that battle at Four Rivers, I'm pretty sure. And like
Four Rivers.
Is that what it's called?
You just added two more rivers.
Two rivers.
I was like last night when we fucking played the movie actor game, and I forget it was like maybe Mark Wahlberg and your dad was like four brothers, and we were like fucking brothers, dude. There's so many Mark Wahlberg movies out there, and you hit us with four fucking brothers.
Yeah, maybe that's what I'm confusing with. I got four brothers still in my head now, Two Rivers. But yeah, they did emphasize because I mean like her, but
okay, they did with Darla Goff, like
they had to go all there because she was so incapacitated from taking that knife from
him. And Lan's dad as well, Tan Althor, he gets cut and he's all fucked up.
Lan's dad,
oh my god, you're so right. Rand's dad, Tan Bruce Althor. Bolton. Yeah, Bruce Bolton. All right, so moving into our final storyline, this is the White Tower storyline. You can just talk about everything before the kitchen scene, so we get kind of Egwene traveling through the tower. I thought this was a great reintroduction to her as a character, the White Tower as a setting and everything. It's kind of her just like, you know, moving through the different rooms of the tower. She starts in the Ammerlin's room, actually. We get to see Lian Sedai again, who is the keeper. It's kind of the Ammerlin's right hand woman. Dave was very close at throwing a random guess out of what her name was, so I appreciated that. Paul, on the other hand, no idea.
You don't like to have fun, do you?
We'll deal with that later on, I guess. And we see Alana again, and she's, you know, a little tussle with the warders in bed. You know, I know Paul liked that part. We get to see, you know, warders training, and then Egwene heads down to the kitchens with all the dishes that she has. So I guess just like thoughts on like this reintroduction to Egwene's character, this kind of the start of season two.
I just feel like the White Castle. White Castle? No, White Tower.
I did that last time.
The White Castle's in the Four Rivers on the other side of that.
We're in a different universe, me and Paul.
I did that season one. I called it the White Castle.
We're watching Time Wheel. I don't know about you guys.
It's just another spin of the wheel. It's a different one.
The White Tower definitely feels like more of a place now.
Yeah,
like,
it feels alive.
We got a lot of it in season one, but it feels like we didn't see like the outside. I mean, we got a few shots here and there, but the actual shots of Egwene going through it, I think what you were saying, Kyle, was really good. It really does feel more of a physical special place.
And the Mistress of Nava scene was really cool too. Like the garden outdoor scene inside the White Tower looked amazing. Just aesthetically, it looks like high fantasy, and we're doing it big, and Amazon's killing it with these shots.
Like maybe it's just me being fresh off this Witcher watch through, but like I'm just thinking like Aretuza, and then like we got like our Ciri character with Ran. Like it is this style of story, like it's what it's supposed to, but I just like I'm seeing the White Tower, I'm like, oh, we're at Aretuza, like same thing, you know.
I mean, all these kind of stories, like you said, they have classic beats like this.
Yeah. But it was really beautiful, like you said. Like I think even you said we're kind of like marveling, like you said, wow, like openly, like when we get that shot like over the river of them, like being, like 100 stories up, whatever it is, like it was really awesome to see.
I wouldn't survive here if I had to
walk that high in places, but
it looked great. Just a very, I don't even say what to say, very important. It's just there's a detail when Egwene walks like around and watching like the warders train, there's three girls that are also in white on the railing watching. And you notice that, or rather I noticed because I'm the man, that their cuffs are like rainbows. And then obviously Egwene and Nynaeve just have white cuffs. They'll talk more about that, but essentially they kind of, you know, they're novices at this point. It's just like another little world building thing of like there's levels to the training, so like they're on the lowest rung of the training. That's why they're,
I hear,
you know,
rainbow, and I'm just thinking they're probably right at the point of being like Aes Sedai. They're about to choose their color pretty
it's
much.
Pretty much like, so that's why, you know, Egwene and Nynaeve and all other people are like doing the dishes, and like while those girls are just like kind of hanging out watching the warders train, just kind of showing the levels of the students.
It would suck going through all that, but it would be so worth worth it in the end. I would do anything they wanted me to do.
I mean, dude, sometimes it's like, it's years. Like, I think just like, it's like a thing from the books, like some people are like, you know, novices for like 10 years and then you're the next level is accepted and you're accepted for 5 years. And then
I don't know if I could be a novice for 10 years, but I could do it for like a couple of years.
They also live way longer.
You live way longer when you like can are an Aes Sedai and they can like touch the power. It extends your lifespan. Yeah, that's the word, lifespan.
It feels like all the training Aes Sedai are like watching the warders, like almost like, which one's going to be mine? Like watching them train, they're kind of like growing together, training together.
Look at you, Paul. Look at you, bro.
And this pretty much sums up the whole dynamic between Nynaeve, Egwene, and the White Tower in general. But you find out super early they're going to continue with the trend of season one where Nynaeve pretty much is bitches about everything. And Egwene is just completely in it for the experience and the ride. And she wants to lean into all this. So it's just like completely opposite ways of looking at the White Tower and all this training. And they reemphasize that 3-4 times throughout this episode, but they reestablish that like ASAP.
And her beef is that her mom, what was it? Her mom got like rejected by them or something.
The wisdom that kind of raised her.
Was rejected.
Okay. Yeah. Because her parents were killed. Someone like brought her essentially, I guess you could say, quote unquote, adopted her, brought her to the Two Rivers. And like that woman got rejected.
I don't know about the Two Rivers, but Four Rivers.
Yeah. Well, I guess they were on their way to the Four Rivers. They just stopped at the first two and then made a home. Yeah, and we're like, these Two Rivers ain't bad.
I'll take it.
Okay. Who needs four, right? And you have two. So this kitchen scene is, you know, Egwene goes to the kitchen. Like Luke said, a big point of this, the beginning of this scene is, you know, Nynaeve's reluctance to, I guess, in her opinion, was waste time because she's like, dude, they literally told us the last battle's coming and like we have all these roles to play. And like we literally have done nothing but do fucking dishes for 6 months. Like, what the hell's going on? Mm-hmm. And then Alana shows up and then we have a very great scene, which is just kind of a lesson. This is our first lesson that we've seen in a while on how to use the One Power. So I think this answers a lot of questions that especially Paul, we talked about in season one. So I guess just like all your thoughts on this kind of training scene.
Loved it from a viewer's perspective. Gave us the five different threads: air, earth, fire, spirit, water, I believe.
Yep.
So that's cool. Like you can pull on one or pull on multiple different combinations. It's, you know, just a good solid magic system.
Mm-hmm. And the coloring of it was sick. I just didn't expect to see like the earth one looking green, mixing it with it, that all of that's good. And I'm happy they're gonna kind of lean into the more the visual aspect of it, but also keep in mind anybody that doesn't have the power is seeing nothing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So it's just like them going like, you know, like just dancing and stuff. So
yeah, literally. And it was funny like listening to interviews of people asking, what's your mindset as an actor? Because obviously all that gets added in at the end. So like they're just kind of dancing and doing their dancing, you know?
Like when Jaw Red Lady Leandrin. When she is forcing like Nynaeve against the wall, I'm just thinking like if the visual effects weren't there, she's just like,
But they said it like you just gotta fucking go 100%.
You gotta just visualize it, otherwise you just feel like an idiot.
Yeah, because if you don't go 100%, like it's gonna look bad. So like you literally just need to, you know, gung ho and throw yourself into it.
I feel like in animes or in fantasy in general, there's like a first initial lesson for the magic users to do. It's always really cool, depending. And this is a really good like first one. I feel like it's a very basic step of just like calling on two different threads and weaving them. You know, the fact that you can't leave unless you drink your water, that was just, you know, a cool ultimatum. And Nynaeve says, fuck your magic, I'm gonna drink this myself and then go fucking shit my brains out.
Yeah, for sure, pissing out her butthole after that. For sure. So in season one, episode one, we had the conversation of, is Moraine, when she's channeling, is she like pulling the fire itself? Is that like the source of the power, or what is it? And I feel like they did a good job kind of explaining it here, where like she says threads of earth from the stones of the tower, threads of water from the air or the water around you. So they are kind of pulling on those types of elements around them.
Like life energy.
Yeah, it's just good. Honestly, like when I was trying to explain the power to people who had not read the books, it honestly is kind of like, to me, it feels like tripping on mushrooms a little bit, where it's like you have to have that like that connection and like feeling it like that and like the ecstasy of how it feels for you. This might just end up being like a teaching method where it's like, you know, visualize the stones the earth.
Yeah. Poor Egwene, man. She's just trying her hardest. She's trying to be the best student possible. Like even she was just saying, even the Amyrlin did this. Like we're just paying our dues.
Yeah.
Trying to cast without using her hands, trying to touch the One Power without using her hands, because she's like, I'm not here to do easy mode, I'm here to do hard mode. and then constantly gets dunked on because she's next to Nynaeve. Who's just like, oh, what did she say? Egwene
is stronger than most, but Nynaeve is 10 times the power of her.
She's like, what the fuck?
And Egwene has a little look on her face like, motherfucker.
Yeah, she was like smirking because she was like, Egwene's strong. Stronger than most, and she's like, "Oh yeah, cool." And but she's not even fucking close to touching you, and it's just like this chick doesn't even care.
She hasn't verbally complained yet, though. It's just all body language.
I'm just now thinking, like, I wonder if that's going to cause a rift in their relationship at all, because like Egwene obviously wants to give it her all in training. Like, imagine if Nynaeve had Egwene's want to like be there. Like, Nynaeve would be done this shit in no time.
That Nynaeve hasn't embraced the source yet. Right?
Yes, very important point is that she has not channeled once since they got to the tower. So that's like a thing.
And that's the whole sitters with the Mistress of Novice meeting, right, that we're going into right now?
Yeah, just like a fun book thing, I think, is that like when Alana's saying, like, close your eyes and picture a flower, and like it's like a whatever, it's red, all that shit. That is how they teach them to channel in the books. And that's how Egwene does it. So like throughout the early books, when Egwene is still kind of new to channeling, and she always is like thinking of the rosebud and like the rose petal and things like that.
Yeah. Let me take a little bit of this next scene. So this is exactly what I just mentioned. Like, the Mistress of Novice is a very important title in the tower. They're responsible for all these newbies coming into the tower, and they're supposed to overlook them. They even punish them. They scold them all the time, but it's all in the hope of just training them to become apprentice. It's to weed out who won't become an apprentice. So that's why she's like asking for all this feedback from some of the sitters. We see Leandrin there. And some things that I took away from this conversation are, I think it was Leandrin specifically says, like, or maybe it was the Mistress of Novice. One of them says the amount of novices that the White Tower is receiving every year is going down, and the ones that are coming in are significantly weaker than most. And this connects back to the end of season one, where the Father of Lies is like at the Eye of the World, says, like, last time you tried this, you came with 99 of your other eyes had died. You guys were way stronger. You knew what you were doing. So basically right now, like, the state of magic on the good side is like the poorest it's ever been. Everybody's weak. It's rarer. So even the strong Aes Sedai now would have been like the average Aes Sedai back in like the golden age. So like, it's just a weird, weak state that the world's in. That's unfortunate timing with the Dark One getting stronger and stronger.
And that's why Nynaeve is so important to them, because she's the first one that's like, holy shit, we actually have a chance against the Dark One, because
that's what Leandrin said. She wants to use Nynaeve as a weapon because she's the strongest thing that's been to the tower in whatever
1,000 years.
And other thing I'll say, just, and then you guys can talk about whatever, is they do quickly mention, just like a little sidebar, that another false dragon stronger than Loghain has popped up in another country that we haven't been introduced to yet, called Feldea. Background world building, because that's how Loghain got introduced to. He was subtly mentioned, I think, in like episode 2 about him gaining some support. So I like how they do that. There is stuff going on in the background, and they're making sure that if you're paying attention, we are informed, because I'm sure that dragon at some point is going to make an appearance, or whatever, that false dragon. So keep that in the back of your head.
Inject that storyline into my vein. That's very second, because Loghain was great, and Kyle knows this very well. I just love strong characters, and so you're telling me that this guy's going to be stronger than Loghain, who was able to take on like 4 Aes Sedai at once, basically, right now, please.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is going to be at the end of season one. We see those ships and all those people. It was a weird way of using it. Everyone was casting through people. I wonder if this is the same people or just a different faction. But anyway, still looking forward to it.
Should we clarify where this country is versus where those ships that he's talking about were? Is that even important?
Now we might as well. I know they're different.
Geographically, they're close to each other. They're on the same. So the weird thing about the continent is that there's only a west and a south coast. Like, everything else is just extends, and you don't see any. It's like
mountains and desert.
Yeah, it's like mountains on the north is like where the Dark One lives and all that kind of shit is going on. It's just like a mountain range where the Blight is, essentially. That's the top of the continent. Mm-hmm. And then the east of the continent is just like a huge mountain range and then like a desert. So there's only a west and a south coast. And Saldea is on like the northwestmost coast. And then where those ships were coming in was like kind of like mid west coast. So they're on the same coast.
Yeah, that's close to each other.
On the same coast. And then Tarvalon, as they say in the show. I was funny listening back to our podcast of me like going back and forth between like the one I in the audiobook and the one in the show. I'm trying Tarvalon is like northeast.
One quick thing that I just remembered about those people on the ships at the end. They, like I said, they look like they are channeling through people. We got Egwene and Nynaeve being, when they were taking their lesson, they said that, you know, at the battle at the end of season one, she, I forget her name, please forgive me, the princess that used the magic, used Egwene and Nynaeve's. She drew on their power. So maybe that's what, you know, the people on the ships are doing that attacked at the end. They're literally...
It's like a form of linking?
Yeah, just like almost capturing people and then using their power because it just makes them stronger.
Yeah, I think you're doing a great job of thinking about kind of the mechanics of the world and how they can be applied in other situations. So that makes up for not remembering Lyanna Sedai's name. So there you go. You're off the shit list. Although White Castle is kind of...
That's close.
Classic.
Yeah, that's going to be a staple for the pod going forward now.
So just like other little bits of tidbits that we get that the hunt for the horn has been announced in Ilion. So Ilion is where Baal Domin was from. So we're kind of building up that place a little bit. We're learning more about it. We know that the horn is like Perrin and Loyal are on like the actual hunt for the horn because we know it's a real thing and we're actually chasing it. But the hunt for the horn that they're announcing is more of like a ceremonial thing almost. They do it like every so often. It's technically every like hundreds of years. Leandrin's using that as like shit's fucking changing in the world right now. Like, you know, crazy stuff's happening because I'm sure like the last hunt was announced like 400 years ago. That will be a thing that's going on in the background kind of throughout most of, I would say this season, maybe next like few seasons of like, we'll meet hunters like out in the world, you know, things like that. So like, that's good that they dropped that this early. We also learned that there's Trolloc raids near Arafel. They say Arafel is just like a similar, like it's a borderland nation in the north, kind of like Shinar, same type of deal. Trollocs are now raiding more. So it's just like, it's all of these things that are contributing to Leandrin having this feeling that like something's fucking going down. I mean, now the dragon's been reborn, they don't know that yet, but the wheel is spitting things out in this like nature where it's like, okay, we're building up to some like, you know, insane kind of point in history that we're at. We also get a little interesting background on Leandrin that she has, I guess, was killed a novice, for lack of a better way to say it, in training. So she's permanently banned from training novices, which I think is some really funny world building. Maybe not funny, it's kind of sad, but it's just like adds to her mystique.
What was her comment back?
Yeah, she was like, the one touching the one powerful is dangerous, dude. It's just like you're taking the risk.
Yeah, literally blame or fault whatsoever.
She's funny.
And dude, Kate Fleetwood, the actress, is amazing. She's so good at it. I fucking love it.
Mm-hmm. And she's the star of this next scene too. So
Well, we get Nynaeve training with the swords for a second.
Yeah, which is an interesting little wrinkle they've added. I'm not against her having this connection with the warders, and it's nice that they had that conversation with her. It's just like an interesting change they've made that she's like legit besties with these guys.
She was bonding with them in season one.
Yeah,
got like campsites and all the fires and stuff like that. She like chose the warders over like all the Aes Sedai and stuff like that.
So like, I'm like, is she again just compared to the Witcher? It's like Ciri. Like, is she gonna be a Witcher? Or is she gonna be a mage? Like, I mean, obviously she's gonna be the strongest mage probably that we've seen besides Rand, I'm guessing. But so I'm obviously inclined to go that way. But I've definitely thought it was interesting that we're getting all these perspectives of her. Not only just in this scene, but in like the past season of her connecting with warders. So it's just something that I caught.
I like that they put her in her place too when she doesn't say Alana Sedai.
Yeah. Because I mean,
they also praise her though. They do say like, you're not bad with a sword. So like, I think she's just going to be eventually when she matures out of all this like hate for the Aes Sedai and everything, I think she's just going to be an all around badass of just magic and sword wielding.
She's going to have a fire sword she's just gonna roll around with.
So
that would be the best way.
Anyone getting fire swords, more fire swords, please.
But yeah, like that's a good call. Then Nynaeve is clearly confrontational to them. That's a thing in the books, is that like, I believe his name's Maxim or Maskim. Like he said, corrects her and says like, it's Alana Sedai to you. Like that's a big thing in the books, is that Nynaeve always forgets, quote unquote, forgets to kind of give them the honorifics all of the time. So it's nice that they've kind of have continued that little bit in the show. All right, so we get a really funny scene after this, which is Egwene and Alana. I am just a huge fan of Alana's actress and like what they're doing with the character. And this was just like a really funny scene where she kind of misinterprets Egwene. This got a really big laugh out of me the first time I watched it. So just kind of, I guess, curious thoughts on this.
She's a horny motherfucker over there. She's like, release yourself to it. Don't get overwhelmed. Obviously talking about the one.
I don't think I loved it because I expect it different out of Alana in terms of like being a mentor and stuff like that. So I'm going to reserve my judgment until I see more of how she is. This the, are they going to lean into this lane like more often of her just not airheaded, but like whimsical and just like less serious of a character? Cause I kind of wanted a little bit more with that scene because Egwene was like, all right, I'm out. Like, you're not helping me. She does drop a little bit of advice, but That's pretty. I'm just pausing right now my thoughts until I see more.
That advice was awesome, though. She was like, "Oh, you're not talking about sex. You're talking about touching the one power. Oh, mm-hmm. It's probably because you're focusing on the individual like grains instead of like it as a mass.
Yeah,
and touching earth and water at the same time. So I don't know. It's just really cool explanations of it.
Yeah, and I like the quote of Egwene. Remember, things are messy before they're perfect. Nothing worthwhile is neat and tidy. Because Alana does say in that meeting that they had in like the kind of the garden that Egwene just really needs to loosen the fuck up. She's just like trying so hard to be good and perfect and everything. It's nice, I think, that they're establishing that little bit of like a mentee mentorship relationship. You know, that she feels like she can go to Alana with these kinds of questions, even if Alana might not understand the question at first and give her an answer she's not actually looking for. Okay. So we then get Nynaeve training alone in the kitchen. This is, I feel like it's just like a classic thing where like, you know, she actually wants to be good, but doesn't know how to like show and like, you know, try hard and get that fear of failure type of deal, like in front of other people. So she does it on her own. Liandrin comes in and gives her quite a unique lesson in the one power and channeling.
This scene was amazing. I thought this was incredible. This was almost the best physical showing of the power. But yeah, like Liandrin, just the way she whips out the Full Metal Alchemist like freaking blade arm was so cool out of air. That was amazing. And then just like knowing how to get under Nynaeve's skin and trigger her, it probably instilled more Nynaeve right there than like all of her other lessons combined, and it's going to go a long way. So we're definitely going to be seeing more how she learned and grows from this moment. But what'd you guys think? Did you like how Liandrin went about this?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of referenced it last season. Moraine said that she couldn't really use the one power until her Aes Sedai that was training her came in and beat the shit out of her with the one power until she like could defend back. And even the warders, they're not touching the one power, but like they were like, hey, your first week you get beat the shit out of you into the inch mm-hmm. of your life. Just kind of seems to be
hazing,
like,
baby.
Yeah, hazing. But no, I mean, I guess it is like the easiest way to trigger, almost like break, if you're talking about like Mistborn.
I was just gonna say, sounds like this guy's about to make a Mistborn reference.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it did get a response out of her. Like Nynaeve fucking just screamed, and that was the first time she touched the one power, I guess, since the whole shit went down. So. It was maybe not the quickest means, but got some results.
Give a little bit more credit to Liandrin here. I still think she's kind of a little bit of a bitch. Don't get me wrong, but she was so badass. I mean, like Nynaeve counters, obviously, and like shoots the wind back at Liandrin. But like Liandrin so calmly just like after she's like, oh, you finally, there you go. You did it. Like she calmly just brushes it off, lands so elegantly. And just mm-hmm. this woman.
Sick.
Yeah, she's got to be the second strongest Aes Sedai we've seen behind Moraine. So
she
far.
Said you saw that weave once and you were able to copy it. I'm like, yo, that's
huge, too. Yeah. That ability to do that is like very important.
Basically like
the shotting gun.
Shotting gun. I almost said a shotting gun. she also Nynaeve triggered when Liandrin was going off about warders and saying they're glorified dogs, like even your precious land. And that's what really triggered Nynaeve. So
yeah.
Don't forget about that romance.
Yeah.
Is there ever a chance for land to be Nynaeve's warder?
They kind of talked about it a little bit.
We've talked about this, I feel like, in season one, but I don't remember how the conversation went. But like now that Moraine, like,
possible, but
I mean, especially now with Moraine, I mean, I fully believe that Moraine is going to get her powers back somehow. This has definitely opened up way more of a possibility of land moving to Nynaeve, who actually, you know, has powers. That's all I'm thinking, really.
Put a pin in it. We'll see. It's on the board now.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I would say within, like, I don't even want to say the laws of physics, but like the laws of the world, how things work, technically it's possible.
Okay.
I guess would be an answer for that. I literally have an all caps Kate Fleetwood is a queen in my notes because she was just so good in this scene as well. And a very similar scene to this does happen in the books. It's the Amyrlin seat that happens with. Instead of Liandrin, which is even more like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, afterwards, they're like, okay, we're never going to talk about this.
Isn't she like choking her out?
That. Yeah, Nynaeve's like fucking like her up, basically. And they're like, okay, we're never going to talk about this again.
I feel like I like that. I feel like that would have, I mean, sure, here, like I said, Leandrin's badassery kind of comes out a little bit here, but like, it would have been like an honor almost to have the Amyrlin seed coming to you and being like, let's get your shit going, you know, like,
yeah, they're on, they're like a boat. They're coming, they're going from Faldara, where they obviously ended. Season one, book one, and then the Amyrlin comes and talks to Egwene and Nynaeve, and they're there together, and like it happens, and they're like, okay, let's never talk about this again, type of deal. And that's also the scene where the Amyrlin's like, you fucking, because you're supposed to call the Amyrlin mother, and like 90, you know, like I said, quote unquote, forgets a lot. So then they're all pissed off at each other. And then it just like is the outburst. And it's like, okay, I just fucked up the Ireland Sea. All right. So after this kind of emotional thing for Nynaeve, we then get a conversation between Nynaeve and Egwene. They got Perrin's letter that he sent them. And so then they're talking about home, their friends, because it is bell time, as Egwene informs us, which also lets us know that it's been pretty much, it's a year since season one, episode one. So I think that was a nice little timeline drop for us. No thoughts about the letter. Interesting. Okay.
Dave, this is when Dave goes
the bathroom bed. Scene. Yeah. Hey, this is time to hit the restroom real quick.
Just reemphasizing that they think Rand is dead.
Yeah.
And that was, they're missing him. And well, we did get a little sneak peek of somebody with a shaved head. It was cool to see him. No lines, just a little peek. Hopefully he gets to shine a little bit in episode two.
His voice actor is going to be different. There's no lines.
That would be crazy. Can you imagine? And yeah, I think an important thing too here is like Nynaeve kind of telling Egwene, I'm not going anywhere. Like, I'll always be here. Because I feel like, you know, obviously like Luke said earlier, like Nynaeve is clearly being like, I fucking hate this shit. Like, I don't want to be here type of deal. So I think it's nice that they have this kind of like reconnection. At this point, because like we've also said, Egwene could easily, you know, be getting jealous of her. So, you know, they really only have each other, so they shouldn't be fighting like this. And it's nice they're kind of reconciling like this.
It's just like a good full circle moment for the Emmett Fields Five. Everybody gets their second to shine, and I guess we'll talk more about Matt in a second. But like, yeah, like we saw the Egwene and Nynaeve bonding. We get to see Rand also doing this ceremony by himself, which is supposed to be like the reveal that he's alive, which obviously. Yeah. And then Perrin himself has the, again, internal struggle of trying to let go of his wife. He almost puts his wedding ring down on the boat, but then last second pulls it back. So it means that he's still living in his head and he's still dealing with all this, which is going to make for an interesting revelation. Like if he does come into some confrontation with Pod and Fane sooner rather than later, because he's still going to be split all over the place, not knowing what to do. That's why I'm hoping like maybe he has some more conversations with Elias soon and like starts to figure things out. But then, yeah, should we go right into the Matt stuff? Because we haven't even, because that's also all connected to the letter. Because Leandrin, again, just goes down. You can see that he's in the White Tower because Leandrin's reading him the letter, but she purposely leaves off any mention of Matt himself from Perrin, which I guess is her way of just fucking with him. Like she is just doing all this crazy, you know, string pulling, whatever it is, but like trying to break Matt down even further. And you can tell because he says some important things here. He says, I haven't touched a dagger in 6 months. I'm basically just like in fetal position, sitting here crying all the time. Like he is just depressed and he's destroyed by his interaction with that dagger. And then it seems like he's locked in the cell. And then we see I don't know. Did you guys take that as did he want to just like, does he have his way of seeing outside, or is that a Shawshank Redemption thing where he's like building he's trying to get his way out? Like, how do we take that?
I kind of didn't know. I took it as two different ways. One, yes, he's looking and seeing if he can possibly escape or something like that. Or two, he is hiding something else. Like he was able to smuggle something in and he is keeping it there and hiding it behind that brick or whatever, so the Leandrin or any Aes Sedai can't find it. I don't know what it would be. If it was
a regular old
dagger,
it's probably just a regular old butter knife. It's like, I just need the sensation of the knife in my hand. So
that's an interesting take.
No,
don't hate it.
No, I agree with Paul completely. I think it was, I really didn't know how to take it. I kind of took it as, you know, a means of escape, or like, you know, he is hiding something else. I mean, obviously we know the dagger's with Pat and Fame, but like it would be wild of a twist if he somehow still did have it. But
that would legitimately solve almost all of my gripes related around the dagger. If the dagger that Pod and Fane had at the end of season one wasn't the real one, that answers the loyal thing. And then it also adds on to Matt being like sketchy and choosing not to go through the ways. So that would actually be the best answer for me. I am 100% confident it's not the answer.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Well, 99%, I mean, I guess. Yeah. But because I feel like Pod and Fane's too not gullible enough. He would know, I feel like. But that would solve a lot for me. That was true.
So, okay. I'm just thinking of the quote from season one where they're like, one of you is the dragon reborn. Some of you might turn to the dark side, you know? So like, obviously candidate number one right now is Matt because of how shitty he looks right now. And like, Leandrin is like just feeding into this. I know she like is not the most fond of men in general. She could potentially be creating an evil person, you know, just by keeping him captive here. I don't know if this is all because of its withdrawal. Like, does he still actually have withdrawal for the knife? Like, is she actually, maybe it's a year of like this shit that he has to go through before he's actually gone with the knife. I don't know, but like, I just feel like she is feeding into the badness that is going through Matt right now.
I mean, she literally has him in like solitary confinement.
Yeah. And like the fact that she like didn't mention him in the notes, like that's just completely in my mind. I don't know again what her goal is, but like it's just someone watching. I'm just like, she is just purposely fucking with him. Like, that's just, there's nothing.
Men,
yeah. Everyone. She hates men to the point that she's about to create potentially like a new dark friend, like under their own like house. I don't know. It's weird. I don't know. We'll see.
Really quick comment. If anybody out there has ever played the game Claw, it was for the PC, Windows, way back in the day. You open up, you're in a prison room like this, and he goes behind a brick and sees like a note that was left by the prisoner before him. Really cool.
Unrelated. Did you just spoil the game?
No, that's the opening scene.
Oh, okay.
But you're saying it could.
It reminded me completely of that. And maybe there was like somebody else in there before him, and maybe he's going to find something left over hidden.
Coincidentally, the person in that room before him also had touched the exact dagger.
Yes, the dagger cell. Yeah,
I've been stuck here for 500 years after touching this dagger.
Yeah, it's interesting if it is true that he hasn't touched the dagger in 6 months. Just, it's a storyline in the books essentially that like, because he doesn't have it on him, like he gets like really, really sick. That's kind of like it's honestly like a D plot, maybe like a B plot in the second book, is that like Matt hasn't touched, like he doesn't have the dagger and it's still kind of impacting him. So he's getting like sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker kind of. So
really,
I wonder, I wonder if they're going to play on that at all throughout the season.
It didn't even like look that bad of a transition between the actors though.
I was just going to say, didn't even talk about it. So I was like feeling good that we all kind of agreed that the transition was perfect.
It was fine.
My comment was going to be, he is so fucking sick from not touching the dagger that his whole face is just, he's lost some weight. But no, honestly, yeah. When we see him just kind of like moping there, I'm like, that looks like Matt from season one.
Sure, my dad wouldn't even notice.
Honestly, probably not. But he looked good, and I'm excited to see the potential for this character going forward.
You have a take on the new actor, Matt? I mean, Paul?
The actor, Matt.
Actor, Matt, Paul.
No, pretty much exactly what Dave joked about. I was gonna say so.
You're a little pouty. That's why you say.
Now I'm
kind of pouty over there.
Think of a new joke. Yeah. Like, now isn't that
standing here with my dick in the hand? And Kyle points it out too. Yeah.
That's what I'm here for, baby. Okay.
Fucking take her home.
That's, I was gonna say, that's all the episode content. There is like a crazy montage at the end. That's like, it's kind of like a trailer, but in my opinion, it felt like, I don't know if I want to let them watch this. It's a little better just to watch the season itself. You know, as a fellow Binge Town member, B-Toms likes to say that trailers fucking suck and they ruin things. So I think at some level it would have ruined something. So we ain't going to talk about it. But if you watched it, I hope you enjoyed it.
We've done this for a couple of our shows that we covered in the past. We did it for Yellow Jackets. We did it for House of the Dragon. Probably a few more. But what we like to do, especially for fantasy shows like this, where there's a lot going on, we're going to go around round table and everybody's going to nominate their MVP and then their LVP for the episode. I'll start just because I'm just like introing it right now. And we don't repeat either. So if your answer gets taken on the fly, and that's also why I want to go first. Yeah.
Let me go.
My MVP is actually going to be Leanne.
Fuck!
No. We've all been talking about it throughout this episode in a way. I needed to steal that first, but she was amazing. Like, she's just great. She's a great presence in the White Tower as just like an antagonistic Aes Sedai. And every scene she's in, she's always got to have some, you know, cheeky lines or cheeky motivations, whatever she's doing. And I can't get over how cool the air blade was. Yeah. Like, that was just so incredible. And her interactions with Nynaeve, it all fits perfectly with her character. And I'm really excited for that dynamic going forward. So that was the easy MVP. And my LVP, I kind of let it slip in just how I was talking about it earlier. There wasn't really a clear option for me. So I'm just going to pick Alana just because of me wanting more from that scene with Egwene and her through the mentorship. But I'm sure as that grows on me and it continues, I'll be able to look back in hindsight and say that was like a seed plotter for how their relationship was going to go, and I'll like it more. But right now, just in my head, I didn't really want Alana to be, I wanted her to show a little bit more, not professionalism, but like give meaningful advice right off the bat. So like, well, as that goes on, I'm sure my opinion will change on that. But right now, MVP Leandrin and LVP Alana.
Paul, you can go next.
Yeah, thanks. I'm just sitting here thinking of one now. All right, obviously, I was going to say Leanna. She's got a lot of fingers going.
Leanna is who you forgot.
Okay.
Leandrin.
Leandrin. Oh, wow. I don't even get to say that anymore. I guess I got her name.
You're beat.
She's got her fingers in a lot of different pots, is what I was going to say. But if I got to get a new MVP, I'm going to go with actual trio and it's going to be the Airbnb hostess.
Oh, you bastard. You fucking bastard.
Because not only are they guarding and shielding Moraine and Lan, but they also save their asses at the end.
Fire sword.
And show their power, which was really cool.
Yep. So right now, Varen is one for one. She's been in one episode and she is an MVP in someone's eyes. So that's a good start for Varen.
The LVP is going to be Master Domin from just getting swindled from fucking Moraine.
Fair.
Like he's a cool guy and everything, but he got absolutely swindled by the oldest trick in the book.
That's a fan favorite character right there. So that's
He's got some catching up to do.
Creating a lot of enemies right now.
Yeah, seriously.
I'm excited for him. He's only at the bottom now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Dave, would you like to go next?
No, I'm stuck on my MVP after Paul took my trio.
Okay. My MVP is going to be Elias. Just because he got like the biggest reaction out of me, I think, just of any scene and like any character being introduced. I was like, yo, like I was so hyped because the question was when Loyal's like, oh, you know, we got a new like tracker or sniffer. And I was like, oh, my God, it's going to be. So in the book, it's a different guy. Like I said, his name's Huron and he's a good character, too. He's a nice guy. And I was like, oh, cool. This is gonna be sick. I wonder who Huron's going to be. And then they fucking flash to him. And I was like, this fucking. So I was like, oh, let's go. So that's MVP for giving me my favorite moment. And then LVP is a little tough because I kind of like everyone.
Yeah,
but
right.
I'm going to say Moraine because she is obviously she's dealing with a lot.
Vibe killer.
But yeah, she's quite a vibe killer. And she's really fucking crushing Lan here. And I don't think she knows that she's doing it too. And clearly there's she has a reason behind it. But like, I don't know. It's kind of like a little much. For me, for my taste, because I'm a big Lan guy.
Obviously. LVP does stand for least vibey person. So.
Yeah.
Well,
that's totally Moraine. Jesus.
Alrighty. We have recovered from our choices being stolen. So we're going to start with MVP being, I don't know. His name is literally written down as Inktar.
It's a G. It's a G, not a K. Ingtar.
Okay, I have it as Ingtar.
Yeah, I saw that on your notes.
Yeah. All right. So Ingtar, just because, you know, I'm hoping that his words will eventually reach Perrin. I think he had a really good moment with Perrin, obviously. Yeah. And
like that anime storyline.
Yeah.
It does seem like he reads manga.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
sure.
I think so, too. So I like him going forward. LVP, we'll give it to Nynaeve. Was not vibing with Nynaeve a lot, to be honest, this episode. She was just a little... She was a little bratty. I mean, I get it. Like her
classic 90.
Yeah, her backstory is definitely like I get why she would have these like feelings of hatred towards the Aes Sedai and everything. But at the same time, they did just say you are the most powerful person to walk through these doors in 1,000 years. Let's take your job a little bit more seriously. Let's get some actual focus going. So I'll give LVP to Nynaeve.
Yeah, she's pissing away all that potential at the moment.
Yeah.
And Gwaine ain't fucking happy about it either. Neither is Dave. Okay. I just on the fly thought of this. We did it a lot in season one. Just curious if we want to go around and just give our top three characters at the moment. And then we can kind of, I guess, maybe see how they change. I don't know if we want to do this every episode, but I mean, just something.
Like right now and then maybe at the season finale.
Yeah, just put it on the board for now. And then, I mean, it could be classic. We'll say top three and then we'll fucking probably morph it into top five. But just curious.
All right. Since I was last, I'm going to lead us off. And I'm just no particular order. I'm just. This is going right off the dome. It's gonna go. We're gonna say Lan, Padden Fane, Dark One. We're rooting for the Dark Ones, baby. Let's go.
He knew as that was coming out of his mouth. That was
all right. That's quite the fucking start. Paul, what do you got?
I want to go Lan as well because he's a beast. I want to go Perrin because his powers awakening are really cool. Mm-hmm. Really excited for him going forward. And then I want to do Rand only for the sense that I'm really intrigued by him and his training and what he's been up to. I know we didn't really get him, but I'm probably putting him in my top three because I'm excited to see him.
All right. Luke?
So are we doing this from like perspective of every like just this season?
No, just like where you're at right now.
Collective seasons.
Dude, it's so hard to not be biased being me and you, Kyle, I think, because like Rand... He's in there. I don't care.
Rand, I mean, say like he had a good end to last season. So, yeah. You know, like there's only been one episode of season two.
I'm going
to
say
based off mostly last season.
Rand. I'll say Rand, Moraine and Padden Fane, because I also just love the archetype of Moraine. And it was a weaker episode for her, but like she's still just so interesting every time she's on the screen. So I'm going to pick her as like, and then Pot on Fane's just like awesome.
Yeah. Okay. Mine's, I'm going to do Perrin. So I'm an OG Perrin guy to the day I die. And then Rand, because how can you not like the DR? And then I'll do the Dark One as well, because I really like his actor.
Yeah.
Mine, I feel like mine are going to be very subject to change just because I'm just thinking like
yours were throughout the whole season.
But we're also not going to get like, I just don't see us getting that many scenes with like the Dark One and Pat and Fane in it. So like, I just feel like other characters as they shine through with more like screen time, I'm just going to appreciate that.
It will just be fun to see how it ebbs and flows throughout. Yeah. All right. So that is going to do it for Wheel of Time, Season 2, Episode 1, A Taste of Solitude. We'll be back, obviously, with Episode 2, Episode 3. Obviously, Amazon does their drops where they do, you know, they dropped all three on, what is it, September 1st? Or it says the weird classic midnight. I think it's technically August 31st. And then we'll be back weekly. So we'll be dropping, you know, a lot of, you know, these first three episodes will come out fairly rapid fire. And then we'll be here every week. We don't have like a day scheduled yet for what we're going to do. We're also not good at being consistent with scheduling things. So they'll probably just fly off the shelves. So the best way to keep up with it is just going to be subscribe. You like that? How I brought that back around. If you subscribe, you'll just get the notifications. You don't need to have like a calendar thing set. It just pops up and you're like, oh my God, Binged on TV, dropped a new Wheel of Time deep dive. That's fucking awesome. So yeah, we're also covering a lot of other shit at this point. I mean, this is busy, busy, busy for us. We're doing One Piece live action. We love, you know, fantasy sci-fi stories, but we are huge anime and manga fans. One Piece live action, really excited about that. We're also covering Jujutsu Kaisen, which is an anime. And then I don't know if we're doing anything else, but we do a ton of shit. We're busy.
Yeah,
we're just busy guys.
Right? We're so busy. We're covering two shows.
We're just busy guys, all right? So that's what I'm trying to get across. We got priorities. And we've covered a lot of stuff in the past, so definitely be sure to stick around and find out.
Stick around and find out. It's a chart. That's our new chart. It's not fuck around and find out. Stick around
and find out.
All right, bye.
Sign this off.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.